Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the 311th edition of the Feuersteins Fire American Soccer Show. I'm your host, Daniel Feuerstein. You can read my articles at Once a Metro and the many other websites of SBNation.com. Today's show, we're going to discuss the U.S. Soccer giving sanctioning of second division to both the United Soccer Leagues and the North American Soccer Leagues, and to see if this well, let's just say it. Let's just hope that it's been the correct thing to happen, as we've seen this happen in the past before when we've had the issues of both the teams that left USL First Division to create the NESL, of course, later for that 1 year called U.S. Soccer Second Division. At the moment, we have Kartik Krishnayar on from World Soccer Talk. And before we even get to Kartik discussing the situation, let me just say congratulations to the brand new communications officer of the NPSL's Boca Raton FC. Congratulations, Kartik, on the brand new appointment.
Oh, great. I appreciate that. Thank you so much, Daniel. I'll be continuing to do this stuff while I'm in that job. It's an NPSL club, so it's not a full-time job. I mean, when I was the NASL press officer, I did a lot of this stuff. And continue with World Soccer Talk on the audio side, the podcast side, not the written side, during that period. So I appreciate that. Looking forward to it. Today was my first day as VP of Communications for the club, and we actually got a lot accomplished today in day one. Big mountain to climb. Boca Raton FC, for those of you who don't know, are actually competing in multiple competitions this year, the APSL, which is another D4 league, a Florida-based D4 league with teams that are just in the state, and NPSL, so we actually need to have two teams ready to play in addition to some other local tournaments. And obviously, U.S. Open Cup, the team qualified for U.S. Open Cup last year, another qualifying round in March, and played Sao Paulo in a friendly yesterday. And they played the New York Cosmos and Shakhtar Donetsk last year. So and hopefully we'll get to play Orlando City or the Tampa Bay Rowdies this season, friendly or one of the big teams in the state, one of those two we would hope to be able to play.
Absolutely, and that would be a great thing to see, of course. Chad Hollingsworth joins us from Scratching the Pitch, and, of course, you'll hear him later on tonight, whether it's live or not, but you'll hear him on the USL show, of course, and covers FC Cincinnati as well. And Neil Morris, I believe, is with us from WRAL Sports Fan down in Cary, North Carolina. As gentlemen, the U.S. Soccer, after the new year, was announced that both the USL and the NESL will be provisionally sanctioned as D2 clubs or D2 leagues. So at the moment, we will not have a Division III league, but they did say, as this is a provisional sanctioning, to get their houses in order. Now, obviously, we all know about what happened with the NESL. Don't know if there's any house to be in order in the USL, but Kartik, first for you, because obviously the Strikers will not be, I guess, so far to start this 2017 season in the NESL, still looking for new owners to take over the club from the Brazilian group, of course, Ronaldo, the former Brazilian World Cup winner Ronaldo. Let's be honest, Kartik, he was not to be seen at all after the opening of the ownership, which is really sad. And of course, I have made my displeasure known about how he has treated the Strikers. But overall, Kartik, do you think this was a wise move by the U.S. Soccer to give both leagues a Division II sanctioning, only though it's provisional?
I, I, suppose so. I mean, I guess you're kicking the can down the road for 9 months, and you're having to make a decision at that point. I mean, I suppose at this late stage, you didn't want to displace team employees, the players, and now you have clear expectations and clear provisions both leagues have to meet to remain sanctioned. So I guess it was a it was what U.S. Soccer could do as best they could. The thing that bugs me is that they were not able to force USL. I understand this from USL's business perspective, and I completely understand their perspective. They were not able to force USL to take NASL teams or to merge with NASL and absorb NASL. Because to be honest with you, and we can get into this in the next 45 minutes, however long we're here, I'm not, as I think about it over the last week, we've had a week now or 10 days to digest this news, I'm not sure what the point of NASL being an independent league is at this point. A sprawling league with 8 teams spread across the continent or even into the Caribbean, enormous travel costs, a league now that has stated that they want to work with all parties in an amicable way, which we already have a D2 league that's doing that in USL, which is organized in a much more cost-effective way and a much more logical way regionally, and a league that seems to have shed its identity in the sacking of Bill Peterson or the dismissal of Bill Peterson by mutual consent. So I'm not quite sure what the purpose of the North American Soccer League is, other than to have the investors who own teams in that league and have class A shares in that league and then the class B shares with FC Edmonton in order for them to try and recoup some of their investment. That's the only purpose I see to the NASL actually continuing into 2017. And one more point, I think, unfortunately, in this league structure we have in the United States and Canada, a closed league franchise model, I guess this is what ends up happening. You have things based on league ideology and league loyalty over that of the clubs and what's best for the sport as a whole or growing and developing players. So not saying that that's NASL's fault. That's the fault of the structure, and I cannot completely understand why those 8 NASL owners wanted to continue, or 7, sorry, because Jacksonville is going to be league-owned. Those 7 NASL owners want to continue in their own autonomous organization to try and recoup some of their losses, given the way the game is structured in this country.
Yeah, I see what's going to happen there. Neil, of course, he covers the Carolina Railhawks. Steve Malik, of course, Neil, led the owners in that press release saying how basically, you know, they're all in agreement of what Sunil Gulati did. And if I can ask this question, did Sunil Gulati do the right thing, Neil? I think he did. I think he found a way to keep the NASL afloat for another year till everything can get their house in order. And, of course, that led to the parting of ways, or shall I say the sacking, of now former NASL commissioner in Peterson, Doug Peterson. Do you think that was the right way to go? And hopefully, are they on the search for a new commissioner?
Well, taking your first point first, I mean, U.S. Soccer was led by President Gulati. They did what the only thing they could do. There was no legitimate alternate choice. Everybody can say, well, they should have done this or they should have done that. But frankly, their two main goals were to maintain as close to the status quo as possible without sacrificing leagues or teams, and for it not, and if anybody was going to fall by the wayside, that it wasn't going to fall on U.S. Soccer's head. Those were U.S. Soccer's main priorities. Any other decision that U.S. Soccer made would have compromised one of those tenets. If the NASL had been sanctioned as a D3 league, it would have been probably the death blow of the league. And we don't need to go too much into detail on that because I think it's been well covered and it's self-explanatory. If the NASL had been granted D2 sanctioning and USL had been granted D3, it would have been extremely difficult to explain. Because you would have had the NASL with open and obvious waivers way above what the minor ones that they've had through the last several years. While USL, while they have their own deficits when it comes to D2 guidelines, have made demonstrable gains in a variety of areas, and it would have been difficult for U.S. soccer to explain one and not the other. There was a veiled threat of legal action from USL if they hadn't gotten D2 sanctioned and the NASL had. I don't think it would have ever come to that, although USL clearly was sending out signals because they wanted U.S. soccer to at least consider it, because U.S. soccer hates the idea of lawsuits. So that was out there, although I don't think it would have come to pass. So U.S. soccer did what I thought they would do several months ago. The only reason they didn't pull the trigger a long time ago, in my estimation, was because the NASL, frankly, had to do a lot to even get to eight teams for 2017. They had a lot of heavy lifting to do, a lot of things to move around. And so that was, I think, the large part of the delay was based on that. I just want to go back to what Kardik said just a moment ago, and I just want to make sure I understood him correctly. One of the parts he just said was that the NASL lost part of its identity because they sacked Bill Peterson, as if that was a bad thing.
What I'm saying is that just kind of is indicative of it. They don't have an identity separate from USL if they're not in league on the outside of the pyramid, challenging them, pushing the norms the way Bill Peterson did.
And where did that get them?
Whether you agree with that or not,
where did that get them? That got
them
where we've seen them the last several months.
But the point I would make is USL, it's played ball within the system. They have a structure that is more conducive to minimizing losses of clubs at the D2 level. I don't know that there's a purpose for an NASL if USL is playing within the system and playing well.
Now, Here's my point, and just for those listening, for as much as I talk on this podcast and many others, Kardik and I talk privately probably five times as much. So this is there is no secrets to anything that we're saying right now. But here's the deal, and Kardik knows my philosophy on this, and it goes something like this: everything is cyclical. The NASL has a lot to do to keep itself afloat and going beyond this year. There is no doubt about that. And we can get into the details on that as we go along. However, I'm a firm believer that over time, down is up and up is down. And yes, USL traditionally over the last several years has been a more cost-efficient league to both be a member of and to enter. It is not necessarily a cheaper league to enter right now as compared to the NASL. There will always be owners, including well-heeled owners, that would rather get into a league that is cheaper to get into and also can sell themselves, as opposed to a franchise model, as one where you have some semblance of owning your own club. And Kardik knows full well that the notion that USL and MLS's perpetual state of kumbaya may not always be the case. So everything runs in cycles, and what NASL's function is what their function always could have been, which is a robust D2 league. They do not have to be in symbiosis to MLS. They can act as an independent model as long as there are owners who would like to invest in that particular model. Now, they've got to make a lot of changes to make that affordable, but they can do it, and they should have done it years ago. But that's where they're at right now, and it is not. They don't have to have a primary mission of either being buddies with MLS or at odds with MLS. It doesn't have to be one or the other.
And Chad, of course, Chad Hollingsworth, of course, joins us as well. And there were, of course, reports maybe that USL had the NASL right where they wanted them to maybe take the Division II sanctioning all by themselves during all this process, but U.S. Soccer allowing both leagues to have that Division II sanction, even though it's only provisional. Chad, how did you see this, and do you feel the USL has also won, in your opinion, about taking over only temporarily for 1 year that Division II sanctioning?
Yeah, I think this is a net positive for USL. I think they come out of this with exactly what they wanted. I don't know that they necessarily were looking to land a death blow to NASL. Certainly there's been some differences between the leagues over the years and in particular individuals within the leagues, But I think, honestly, when USL set up for D2 status, they were concerned about their own status, not so much NASL. In my opinion, one thing that the Soccer Federation could have done was just finally said enough of this nonsense. Neither league fits the standards that we've arbitrarily set forth for D2 sanctioning and set them both at D3. And I think if it weren't for the precarious status of NASL at the time all of this was coming down, they might have gone ahead and done that. But as Neil quite correctly pointed out, that very well could have been the nail in the coffin. And I think USSF wanted to avoid that if they could. And that's the only reason this got drug out. So USL gets its D2 sanctioning. Jake Edwards has said in public that this is validation. It's respect that the league and its owners felt that it deserved. And they didn't have to capitulate and take on any additional teams that they didn't feel fit their business model. So this is a win for the USL.
Well, we'll see what happens after the year, obviously. Look, I'm happy that the NASL is still around. Of course, we all know I'm happy with what the USL has done since the original split. When we started off with that Division II U.S. Soccer League several years ago, 6 years ago. But now, as they say in the old adage, talk is now cheap, gentlemen. Now we're going to have to wait and see what's going to happen for this second division setup for 2017. And we'll see what happens down the road, I guess, when 2018 comes along. And we'll go straight first with the USL. And, Chad, what do you think USL needs to do? Just stay on the same path? Or do you think they need to find a way to improve themselves? Because, obviously, I would have to assume, and once again, this is just assuming. I'm not privy about what's been going on outside of what's been read about and everything's been tweeted about through our colleagues. And, do you believe that the USL needs to maybe up the game a little bit more, maybe into the second division? Or do you think to just stay on the status quo and just continue on going in that direction?
Well, if you're not getting better, you're probably getting worse. So, yeah, there's still improvements that need to be made. They need to continue to attract well-heeled ownership groups and put them in markets that can support Division II soccer. And along with that, they need to probably start to consider the way they compensate their players. For a long time, NASL has outspent USL when it comes to player contracts. Now we're both D2 leagues. It's probably time to start to consider to pay USL players as if they were Division II players. So, and that's going to require ownership groups with deeper pockets. And that's probably one of the areas where USL lacked in terms of the D2 sanctioning requirements is the number of ownership groups that met the thresholds for D2 sanctioning. So if we can continue to attract new owners and new markets, but perhaps new investors to some existing teams, those are some of the main areas I think that USL could continue to improve.
Yeah, I would agree with you there. Neil, an article written by our colleague Bob Williams from The Telegraph, obviously he writes about the NASL needing to focus more on fans and not the politics of American soccer. And this was said by Miami FC's owner, Ricardo Silva. And obviously, the way that the league was structured before this whole event happened, do you feel Silva is correct in saying that? And do you also believe more needs to be done on the NASL side as well?
Well, that's the mantra coming out of NASL Inc. right now. I mean, what he said echoed essentially the same thing that Steve Malik said in an interview with me a week before, which is just 2 days after the sanctioning announcement, actually, which is they needed to have cleaned house. They needed to have purged a number of things, not just attitude, but approach inside the NASL, and that the new code word is cooperation and transparency. Now, that's a very good first step. It is because it is a marked difference from the approach over the last several years. However, and I don't mean to be a Debbie Downer on this, because I still believe that the NESL can come out ahead on this, but the amount of mileage that they're going to get out of this new attitude mantra is going to be limited, at least from my point of view. It's going to sound good for a while, but the problem is, and this is why I'm sounding continuing to sound a cautionary note, for several years I thought that folks observing the NESL were, every year seemed like a chase to what the next expansion team was going to be. Well, where are you going to go this year, and when are you going to go to the next year? And instead of, in my mind, sort of cultivating the teams and securing the teams that you already had. The problem with 2017 is that the NESL now has to do both. They have to cultivate and reconfigure some of the teams that they already have, the solid eight, or the, well, maybe it's not so solid eight that they have. But they've got to expand, and they've got to expand in short order, and they're going to have to hit the mark every time. There's no leeway now. I mean, maybe there's some leeway if they can add a couple of good teams before next year. Maybe U.S. Soccer extends their rope for another year. Maybe that happens. But they've got a lot to do in a short amount of time. They've got to solidify their base. They've got to expand. They don't want to be in a hurry to expand, and they shouldn't be. But the expansion announcements are going to have to come soon, and they have no margin for error in my estimation. So that's going to be the difficulty moving forward. Yes, the change in approach and the change in attitude is a breath of fresh air, but it's not going to take long for the winds of change to sweep over them again. And frankly, I think that their reliance on this, while it is very welcome, particularly from a media point of view, it's not going to get them but so far, and they've got too much to do in a short amount of time to rely on that too much.
And Kardik, obviously, with what's been going on with both leagues, and especially with the NESL, I mean, the sale of the New York Cosmos was basically hinged towards this league staying at second division. Of course, the New York Cosmos now being owned by a brand new owner, obviously, Mr. Rocco B. Camisio, who is a cable television entrepreneur in the New York City area. His only reason to purchase the Cosmos was to basically seeing the NESL remain as second division now that it has happened. Was the Cosmos, I guess, a big part of keeping NESL alive or not? I mean, I guess that's the big question right now.
Oh, I think it was critical. By the way, has he kept One World Sports on his cable system? So I'm just curious about that. If he's had One World Sports or he's kept them on his cable systems, that might tell us a thing or two. No, I think it was critical that the Cosmos stay afloat because, again, I mean, I said at the beginning, and I should have stopped myself when I said the NASL doesn't have an identity. It does because they have the New York Cosmos. It has a relevance because they have the New York Cosmos in their league still. It has a relevance for media. It has a relevance for people internationally. It has a relevance for those, for lack of a better term, malcontents that want to gravitate to NASL because they don't like MLS. But without the Cosmos, you just have a random collection of minor league teams spread across the continent. So keeping the Cosmos is critical, I think, from just keeping NASL visible and viable in people's eyes. In addition, it turned out to be the eighth team they needed. But even if it had been the 12th team they needed to keep D2 sanctioning, not provisionally, but full D2 sanctioning, I think it would have been critical because it is New York Cosmos after all. We'll see how he runs the team, if he's more humble, if he's more measured in the way he governs his team and markets his team than Seamus O'Brien and certainly before Seamus O'Brien, Mr. Kemsley, who had run, by the way, several entities related to the sport in England into the ground before he came over here and had the hubris he did around the Cosmos as kind of a traveling circus before Seamus bought them and put them into a league, actually had them play competitive matches. So maybe the third time will be the charm for the Cosmos, this reincarnated Cosmos with the right owner and the right philosophy. But like Neil is about the whole NASL picture, I'm cautiously optimistic. I think it's very possible they could get very, very aggressive and hubristic again, the Cosmos. And the early indications are at least based on the tenor of Cosmos fans, that nothing ever happened, nothing changed.
Yeah, we'll see what happens on that part. But as we move forward here, of course, we are talking about the sanctioning of both NESL and USL as a second division league now, or shall I say sanctioning as Division II leagues. There will be no Division III for 2017. And even though it's only for one season, and we'll see what happens after everything has been said and written about it, we'll go individually, of course. We'll go with Chad first, and then we'll go to Neil and then to Kardec. What does that mean for 2017 with no Division III, gentlemen? That's the thing I'm more curious about. I mean, does that mean that the leagues like the PDL and the NPSL remain as Division IV? Do they get an opportunity maybe to become Division III? Where are we looking at into the future now for this year, I should say, for this current U.S. soccer calendar, for which league, if they feel they want to make a move up as Division III? First with Chad, and then with Neil, and then with Kardec. Chad, go ahead.
Well, what does it mean not to have a Division III in this upcoming year? I think in the big picture, it doesn't really mean anything. We lack a really true pyramid in the United States. It's not like we're relying upon one division to produce talent for the next, to produce talent for the next, to produce talent for the next. These are, you know, again, largely arbitrary division designators that the leagues use to entice investors and sponsorship dollars more than anything else. So it's not gonna be the downfall of U.S. soccer to not have a D3 to underpin D2 and D1 in this upcoming year. I don't see USL PDL stepping into that role. They've carved themselves a really nice niche at turning college talent into talent for MLS and USL. And I think they're quite happy to be where they're at down there in the open divisions. And you said D4. Technically speaking, Soccer Federation doesn't recognize anything below D3. They don't have sanctioning for amateur. So with regard to sanctioning, there's no difference between NPSL, PDL, and the Evergreen League out in the Northwest. They're all just amateur leagues. Having said that, I've also spoken to Joe Baroni, the chairman of the NPSL, and asked if his league would be willing to step up and fill a void in Division III should one exist. I talked to him before the decision had been made by the Soccer Federation, and he indicated to me that his league would not be interested in becoming D3. They're very happy doing what they're doing, focused on their own communities, and it's really a community/regional league that comes together at the end of the season for one national playoff. So much the way USL, the now provisional D2 USL, is a national league that is focusing on more regional scheduling and regional rivalries, NPSL is a hyper example of that, where they're very focused on a regional and community level and just happen to have a national championship at the end. So unless things change for NPSL, they're not going to step up and fill that void either. I think what is more likely the case is we'll have some teams in USL who are there now who, for some reason or another, aren't able to keep up with the rest of the league in terms of their D2 requirements. And you might eventually see a D3 USL break off from the D2 portion.
Neil?
There's not a lot I can add to what Chad just said. I pretty much echo everything he just stated. I think, you know, marginally it'll impact when certain teams enter the U.S. Open Cup as opposed to the date of entry. Other than that, the void at D3, to me, matters very little. In regards to the PDL or NPSL moving up, I mean, Chad's absolutely correct. And I'll just amplify it this little bit. People tend to forget in all the tumult over D2 sanctioning that there are D3 guidelines. They're not nearly as stringent as D2, but there are promulgated D2 guidelines, D2 Pro League guidelines, I should say, that U.S. Soccer promulgated at the same time that they established the D2 guidelines that any league hoping to get D3 sanctioning has to meet. If PDL or MPSL was hankering for D3 sanctioning, or if a confederation of the higher owners in those leagues were casting an eye towards D3 sanctioning, there would have already been a movement. But these teams would have to start paying all their players. They would have to have owners of a certain net worth. They would have to establish certain guidelines regarding stadium size, even at a D3 level, or staffing. I mean, there's a whole host of things that they would have to establish on a league-wide basis that would increase their costs without demonstrably aiding in the league. They're very happy where they are. I know Kardec's point of view on all this, so I'm going to leave it to him to sort of give his new statement regarding the extremes of lower division soccer now. But I don't see the absence of D3 being a major problem, at least this year or even beyond, and I don't see MVSL or PDL filling that void, or know that they really want to.
And now we go to Mr. Boca Raton FC and Carter Krishnire.
Yeah, I can't disagree with anything Neil just said. I know his opinion on this, and I'll let him give it, but it's essentially the same thing as Neil just gave you, articulated beautifully. I'll just add this. I think there are a number of people who are fans of the NASL in particular who overestimate the difficulty that teams that are amateur teams would have moving to the professional ranks, moving to the D3 or D2 level and operating effectively and in a cost-effective manner. So I think the void in D3 is not a big deal right now. I don't think it matters a whole lot. And I have to say, this whole thing about D2 surprised me, because I felt like USL had essentially established itself as a second-level league because of its ties with MLS and some of their more successful expansion teams the last few years, Sacramento, Louisville, and Cincinnati, to name three of them, without needing D2 sanctioning to kind of prove that. So I was surprised USL felt like the D2 designation was such a big deal. I had always felt for NASL that when I worked at the league, that the D2 designation didn't prohibit you from being D1 where you wanted to be D1. But I guess these divisional designations maybe mean more than I had thought for several years. So who knows? Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe it is a problem not having a D3, because my track record isn't very good on understanding why people are so eager to have a divisional designation that they feel benefits them in the marketplace. I mean, MLS is not Major League Soccer because they have a D1 designation. Major League Soccer is where they are because they are the established market leader in this country for live soccer, live club soccer, and with clubs based in this part of the world, not Barcelona or Liverpool. So I don't think their D1 designation has anything to do with that, which is, again, why I thought it was surprising USL felt like they needed D2 so badly, why it was surprising NASL felt like they needed D1 so badly. So perhaps I'm wrong. Maybe it is a problem without a D3 league. But for me, I don't think it makes a difference.
What I was trying to tee up for you, I'm curious to see whether you still hold this, is that, and I may misstate your position, but you've said in the not too distant past, I should say, that if a team owner is not in MLS or has a beat on MLS or a line or aspirations, real aspiration for MLS, you've said not too distant that you think that if you're not on that extreme, you're almost better off being a PDL or MPSL owner.
Oh, yeah. Thanks, Neil, for teeing that up for me. I didn't know where you were going with that. Yes, absolutely. Let me state that for everyone to hear this. If you are not seeking an MLS team and want to be an MLS and spend the money, lose the money at the USL and NASL level, like Cincinnati is, like Sacramento is, like your team, the Carolina Railhawks, are Tampa Bay Rowdies here in Florida, in my neck of the woods. If your ambition is not to be in Major League Soccer, I don't think there's any point to having a team in the D2 or D3 leagues right now. Stay at the amateur levels, play PDL, play NPSL, play whatever regional league. You don't have to be in NPSL or PDL. You could be in one of any number of regional leagues we have across the country that, as Chad explained, fit that designation under the USASA, and just run a club that way. That's the way I look at it. If you want to be in Major League Soccer, which I think is the ambition of most club owners, at least in their mind, whether it's realistic or not, is another story. But if that's your ambition, go and pursue a pro club in USL or NASL. But if not, I would say in the amateur ranks. There's one exception to that, I guess, Neil, that I have thought about in, recently, is that there are teams like the Tulsa Roughnecks that have a venue where they need additional dates. So the minor league baseball owners need additional dates in that venue. So it works to have a professional team in USL. But I think that's only a handful of teams, quite honestly. So for the most part, yeah, I don't think these divisional designations matter, in my opinion.
Well, I was going to say on what you were saying before, Kardik, was that, you know, why does it matter what the designations are of which league is Division 1, 2, or 3 when you consistently look at, and everyone's doing this, consistently looking at England, always. We all know the Premier League is the championship, the original Division 1 now is Division 2, Division 3 now is Football League 1, Division 4 is Football League 2. I mean, there's always going to be who is considered sanctioned as first division, second division, or the top flight, you know, somewhere in the middle, somewhere in the bottom. And, you know, I mean, if you feel, gentlemen, that, you know, maybe it's meaningless now because, yeah, I admit, the pyramid is not what it is. The pyramid is probably more screwed up within U.S. soccer than it has been for a long, long period of time. And, you know, what does that mean then, if anyone wants to jump into this? If what's the point of having sanctioning of being a Division 1, 2, or 3 league if in reality – it's just a, you know, it's just a mirage. What do you think, Chad? Go ahead.
I'll jump in real quickly on that, Daniel. I actually have written an article a year ago saying they should get rid of divisional sanctioning because I felt like MLS is the established market leader. They are D1, whether they're called D1 or not. They are miles ahead of the other two leagues. Sorry, NASL fans, they are miles ahead of you, and the gap in play is pretty wide also, if you don't want to believe. I know a lot of NASL fans don't want to believe that. I actually had a discussion with one yesterday who said, oh, well, actually, our teams could compete for playoff spots in MLS. And you're like, oh, okay. You can believe that if you want to believe that. And then my feeling was that there were a lot of NASL teams, when I wrote this article, that were operating at a lower level than USL teams. That having been said, the lowest level teams operationally, and I'm talking about not on the field, but operationally, business-wise, in the American game were generally USL clubs, like Harrisburg, like Pittsburgh, like Wilmington, who's now gone down to PDL. But there were some NASL teams that were operating last season when I wrote this article in 2015 at a much lower operational level than Sacramento and Louisville, who were both USL teams and were designated as D3 teams, while there were D2 teams designated higher than them. So I felt like, why have these divisional designations? MLS is a clear market leader. If you have NASL threatening to sue the U.S. Soccer Federation over divisional designations, why doesn't the USSF just be proactive? And then you also had USL making noise about wanting to be a D2. Just abolish divisional designations. MLS is the market leader. They're always going to be the market leader in my mind. And these other two leagues, there's no need for them to fight it out because they'll all have like essentially co-professional division status.
Go ahead, Chad.
Yeah, I think really, I'm going to say the PNR words here, in absentia of promotion and relegation.
You could... Chad, you're allowed to say it. Don't worry. There's no.
There is.
Listen, just don't mention him. Just don't mention him. You can say the words as much as you want. Say it with me. Promotion and relegation. It's quite all right. You will not be fined, except for Kardik, who said Carolina Railhawks. That's a $10 fine in the cookie jar, Kardik. It's North Carolina FC.
Oh, yeah.
But go ahead, Chad.
Sorry.
Well, absent of promotion and relegation, you know, Kardik's got a great point. These division sanctionings really don't mean much of anything. You're a professional soccer club or you're not, and you're going to operate on a level that you want to be perceived. So he mentioned, you know, in USL, the Sacramentos, the Cincinnati's, the Louisville's, who operate at a very high level. You know, when Crystal Palace came to Cincinnati this past year and played a friendly, I had a chance to speak with Alan Pardew after the game, And I asked him, I said, you know, if you didn't know any better, would you guess that FC Cincinnati was not a Division I team? And he said, absolutely not. So, and that's the point that Kardik is trying to make and that I agree with. It's you put the product on the field, invest in your product the way you want to, and let fans and supporters in your community and around the nation perceive you the way you want to be perceived rather than the way the Soccer Federation tells you that it has to be perceived. And I think for 85% of soccer fans in this country, they don't even really know what division their team plays in. My guess is that most FC Cincinnati fans, when they came to the games, knew that they weren't in MLS, but they also knew they were watching a good product on the field and they were enjoying one heck of a game day experience. And that was what was important. So unless we're going to introduce promotion and relegation into the pyramid, then D3, D2, D1 sanctioning is largely just, like I said earlier, a way to attract investors and sponsorships. For some reason, those sanctionings are important to people who hold the money bags.
Now, I would like to just remind our guests, as well as the listeners out there, whether you're listening live tonight or when you listen to the archive edition once the show is over. We can say the words promotion relegation because, let's be honest, it does factor in how we believe our leagues and how the American game should progress. If you feel it is positive or negative, there is no issues here to say the words. We are just not going to mention the gentleman's name that has not really paid attention to what's been going on in a reality sense. And if this is basically a diss to him, it is. Because why? Because there is more issues what's going on than just promotion relegation. It is one of many issues that is plaguing the way that maybe the structure is happening within our country, within the sport of this country. But once again, there is no ban on those words. Anyone, if you want to say it in a thoughtful and a true manner, you're more than welcome to do so. We are not going to have crazy talk just for the hell of it and then cause a stir for no reason. So the words are allowed. There is no penalty on anybody. I do not have my referee cards, so everyone is fine. It's a brand new slate. It's a brand new everything, but we can talk about it. But as we are talking about it, then, if I can throw this out, and maybe if Neil wants to chime in on this one, well, let's just say for the heck of it that the designations or the sanctioning of Division I, Division II, and Division III should come into play. Then what do we have to do then to go forward to have the mechanism, become part of the fabric of American soccer, Neil?
You mean promotion and relegation?
Well, yes, including the sanctioning of, let's say, MLS Division I. For the hell of it, I'm just throwing it out there as an example. Like, NESL keeps Division II and USL goes Division III. Like, if we have promotion relegation, wouldn't that also mean then we should maybe just keep the designation of sanctioned leagues of which level they're at?
At the risk of, and I do not mean this to sound dismissive, I'm always intrigued by the talk about promotion and relegation. I think it's probably healthy to have a debate about it. It's not going to happen. So, I'm going to totally dismiss the aspect because MLS is not going to do it. MLS is never going to do it. The only way MLS is ever going to do it is whether they do it internally with, luckily, MLS 1 or 2, and I don't even think that's going to happen. I'm going to piggyback a little bit off what Chad said a moment ago, is that, and this is different than what I said a moment ago where I was asked whether the absence or the void at D3 makes a big difference, and I don't think it does this year or next year. This is a distinct answer. Chad is right in this respect. It is clear that D2 sanctioning meant a lot to the leagues involved and, more importantly, to the owners and the investors that are looking into those leagues. And that's frankly because, and this is not just anecdotal, but it's just obvious, that the independent owners who are purchasing clubs in a league or franchise rights in a league and investing in their teams want to feel like they're one step below Major League Soccer and maybe even knocking on the door to joining the D1 league. They don't want to feel like they're perpetually in a D3 league. That may be more perception than reality as far as what it actually means. But, I mean, let's spin it forward. Let's say USL never becomes D2 and perpetually was at D3, and the NESL was the ensconced Division II league. Well, I mean, how long, absent getting a golden ticket to Major League Soccer, how long do some of the independent owners at USL tolerate that and stay inside USL? Not long. Flip it around. The owners in NESL joined the league in part because it was the Division II league. If they had been demoted, so to speak, to D3 and USL had been sanctioned at Division II, it's been widely reported, and I've seen contracts that verify this, that if the NESL had lost its D2 sanctioning, then the amount of money required to leave NESL LLC dramatically decreases from several million dollars to under $50,000. So it's written into the fabric of the membership agreement of the NESL that they have D2 sanctioning. That's how important it is to the league and those investors. Whether it comports with the reality on the ground is irrelevant. It is clear that for the game of satisfying your existing owners and attracting investors, that for whatever reason, the appearance and both reality of being at the Division II level was paramount. We can debate as to whether it makes sense all day long, but it's not just perception. These things have been written into the legal framework of the league. That's how important it is.
Gentlemen, before we continue on this conversation, really quickly, of course, this happened about hour and a half, 2 hours ago. Just to pass along news here, Dax McCarty of the New York Red Bulls now traded to the Chicago Fire for general allocation money worth $400,000. Of course, it was already on MLS.com. SB Nation's Once a Metro, Met Red Bulls site has also announced it as well. Other outlets, of course, it came from Paul Tenorio of 442. So Christian Dyer also confirmed it. So once again, Dax McCarty, now a member of the Chicago Fire, for $400,000 of general allocation money.
Know,
go ahead, Kardec.
Chicago has a lot of cap room, and they made a number of moves right before the trade deadline last year, the free cap room, which is why I know I tweeted that it must have been an April Fool's joke, and then I realized, oh, wait a second, they have a ton of cap room. This may be the first of several moves that they make. So just keep that in mind. This may not be a one-off. They might have a couple more coming of top players in the league that they can acquire.
They probably do, Kardec. But let's continue on with the subject right now. And I guess I would have to ask this question then. I mean, Kardec, you know, where do you see this with sanctioning of leagues or being what it really is? I mean, in Major League Baseball, of course, it's Major League. Minor League Baseball, it's the minor leagues. But, you know, there's the difference between the affiliated minor league teams with the major league parent clubs and, of course, the independent leagues of baseball, like, let's say, the American Association, the Can-Am League, the Pioneer League, I believe it is. I could be wrong, though. I mean, those are clubs that are not affiliated with Major League Baseball, and they have their own season. Same thing with the NBA, even though they run their development league, the NBDL. The NHL has the American Hockey League as their top minor league teams, of course, affiliated with the National Hockey League teams, as well as the ECHL. Of course, I mean, Kardec's probably familiar with a couple of minor league hockey teams in his area, as well as going to Orlando with the Solar Bears. I believe Chad knows about the Cincinnati Cyclones of the ECHL, and I believe Neil also knows maybe a couple of minor league hockey teams, like, of course, Charlotte Checkers, which is the Carolina Hurricanes AHL affiliate. I mean, is that where you think we're going to be heading to next, Kardec? I don't think we'll be. Well, we already know about, you know, USL clubs with MLS club or MLS2 clubs, but it just feels like this is where we're heading to, Kardec, that while the leagues are there, especially more with the USL, you have to be affiliated with a club if you're an MLS team, or you got to run your own MLS2 team.
Yeah, well, the MLS2 team thing is becoming interesting. I spoke to a person who is in an MLS organization yesterday that has a two-team in USL, and this person basically told me the two-team is becoming very cost-prohibitive, and they're not really sure what to do with it long-term. And I think we're going to be moving towards an affiliate model, which I have to say, I think it's probably what Jake Edwards and maybe Alec Papadakis also, but certainly Jake Edwards. Jake Edwards is a great soccer guy, by the way. One of the few really good soccer guys that's an executive of one of the leagues in this country currently. I mean, there are others that are familiar with soccer, but I don't think he quite lived and breathed it the way he has his entire life. So he understands this stuff. And the sense I'm getting from talking to people around MLS is that the cost of maintaining these two teams, unless you're bringing so many players through your system that are going to play for your first team, like the LA Galaxy and the New York Red Bulls. I think those might be the only two exceptions, maybe Seattle. We'll see how it plays out for Seattle. But for the rest of them, I think it's becoming a bit of a cost burden. So I think we're gonna gradually work our way towards more affiliate clubs, some of these MLS 2 teams going away or being spun off. The Rio Grande Valley example of what they've done in McAllen, Texas, and then, of course, Reno coming to the league this year. I think those are very good hybrid models. You'll either see hybrid models like that or just flat-out affiliates. For example, Chicago has done an affiliate agreement with Tulsa now, and Montreal with Ottawa, things like that. I think that's where things are headed. And then you will have some strong independent clubs like Sacramento, like Louisville. Louisville was an affiliate of Orlando initially, but now very strong on their own feet, independent club, Cincinnati, et cetera, Tampa Bay. And then in NASL, I don't know. I mean, again, I go back to how I opened. I don't know what their vision is. I don't know if there is a space for an independent league that is a sprawling league without regional play at the D2 level that does not have any direct tie to Major League Soccer or direct way of kind of offsetting costs for their clubs. Because the clubs that are affiliate clubs in USL, they get cost offsets from players on loan that presumably will be first-team players or close to the first-team squad. I don't know, but maybe NASL does create that niche, as like an independent league, one of those independent minor league baseball leagues you mentioned.
Yeah, I agree with you. And, Chad, I mean, you've seen, you know, the New York Red Bulls 2 team take on FC Cincinnati over at Nippert. I mean, you've seen, like, Toronto FC 2 has their own club. Obviously, Rochester and New England Revolution have an affiliation agreement together. FC Cincinnati, I'm assuming, of course, they are standalone, one of the rare standalone clubs that is not a two team, nor is it affiliated with an MLS team. I mean, that, in my opinion, of course, but you would know more than I would, maybe that's the bit of hindrance for, having a full Division II sanctioning by U.S. Soccer because of the MLS influence of a two team.
Yeah, I've heard rumblings about that, how the Soccer Federation might not have viewed the inclusion of MLS 2 teams as a positive aspect for USL when considering D2 sanctioning. I don't know how much truth there is to that. It's something that's done in other leagues around the world. I believe in Spain, or at any rate, in Spain and Germany, you have reserve teams playing at various portions of the pyramid. And in one or the other of those leagues, the reserve club can be promoted all the way up the pyramid up to the division that is right below where the parent club plays. So there's precedence for this in other areas of the world. I'm not saying that USA Soccer has to copy what goes on in the rest of the world, but there's examples of it working elsewhere in the world. I personally am a fan of the hybrid affiliation that was mentioned, the Rio Grande Valley, the Reno hybrid affiliation, where the reserve team, if you will, in this circumstance, has a completely separate identity from the parent club. It's located far enough away from the parent club that another market can get interested and have a professional soccer team to support, where the business operations are run by an independent ownership group, but the technical aspects are run by the parent club. And Cardick mentioned that that's what Jake Edwards would prefer, and I concur with that. I read that in an interview. I've talked to Jake about that myself. I think that is the direction that we're going to be heading. How many of the current MLS 2 teams convert to that sort of arrangement remains to be seen. I think there's some talk about perhaps Portland looking to do that, forming a hybrid affiliation perhaps with an ownership group in Boise. There's been some talk about Seattle also looking at a similar hybrid affiliation arrangement. But I don't think we'll be adding more MLS 2 teams, at least many more MLS 2 teams in the near future. I think it's going to be the hybrid affiliation is what we're going to be seeing in the future at the USL level. And it's because it is cost prohibitive. It costs a lot of money to run a professional soccer team, especially if you don't have the resources to create a revenue stream to put money back into the team, which a lot of these MLS 2 teams don't. They spend bare bones on marketing and ticket sales, and rightly so. The thrust of their efforts are to get butts in seats in the MLS stadiums for the parent clubs. So I'm not sure this MLS 2 model is one that is sustainable in the long term, and I look to see a lot more hybrid affiliations in the future.
And Neil, as Chad just said, it does cost a lot of money to run a professional soccer club below MLS. I mean, it's already been announced a long time ago. I mean, the original owners of the Jacksonville Armada are looking to sell. I mean, currently the league is going to take over the Armada, but the old owners or the current owner, shall we say, who's giving up his ownership rights of the Armada, he's looking for a new owner to take over. Do you believe that maybe I know they're probably going to be playing at the minor league baseball stadium, but do you think it's also cost prohibitive or maybe helping if this new owner comes in, is there room to build a professional soccer stadium in the downtown Jacksonville area?
Not at the D2 level. And I actually think that in all likelihood they won't be playing at the minor league baseball stadium. I don't know that they've settled on a venue, but they're looking at a couple of college venues and maybe another that I'm forgetting that Cardick can remind me of. But I think the days of playing at the baseball ground there in the middle of town, although it was a tremendous location, they had no control over that venue. They had no presence there. They got a very little. They had to split ticket revenue. They got no sponsorships. They got no naming rights revenue. They had no share of parking or concessions, and the rent was extremely high. So they're not going to be there next year in all likelihood. What's going to happen with Jacksonville is that the league, as Steve Malik has indicated in my interview about a week or so ago, that the league is in the final stages of acquiring the club from Mark Frisch, who basically is done. He's just done. What I suspect, or actually what I know that the league has already forecast for U.S. Soccer, is they believe they have an owner in the pipeline that still has to be vetted and still has to get things up and running on his end. But it is not in time for the league to prepare and run up to the 2017 season. It may not even be in time to start the season. The league expects to have a new owner of Jacksonville sometime during the 2017 season. And the analogy that I've drawn is, I think NESL is doing with the Armada essentially what USL did with Rochester last year, where the current owner was done. The league had to come in and stabilize things and fund and operate while they located or secured or finalized a new owner. And that's the indication I get as far as the Armada. Going back to USL for just a moment, believe me, I give all deference to Chad because this is his beat, so I will defer to what conversations he's had with Jake Edwards. I can tell you, I interviewed President Edwards a couple of months ago on my podcast and served up what I thought was a softball based around the very question that you asked, Daniel, which is whether the future of lower division soccer is this, let's just call it a farm team model. That's just an easy way to refer to it, where essentially you have an independent owner that it's like the minor league baseball model. You have an independent owner that runs the operations and the tickets, and the parent club runs the team side and the player side. And I basically said, is this what we're looking at? Is this the direction that we're heading? And he pushed back on that with me. He said that that's not necessarily going to be the one-size-fits-all answer in every market, that there's always going to be a place, given the particulars of a certain market, for the independent model, which actually kind of surprised me, because I thought, in my mind, that that's where we're headed, that it made sense, even if I didn't particularly care for it, that it was going to be the inexorable tide, sort of like Major League or Minor League Baseball eventually transitioned from an old independent construct to the farm system that we see today. And I still think we may be gradually heading in that direction. But Jake Edwards pushed back on that a little bit with me. And I think if I could – this is just me playing armchair psychologist for just a moment, which is always fun. There's a to and fro going on inside USL right now. They have – much of the success that they've enjoyed the last several years has been in large part because of their partnership with Major League Soccer. There is no doubt about that from a cost point of view and a cachet point of view. At the same time, there is this tension between the independent owners and the MLS influence. There is, while having Major League Soccer teams involved, either where they're a T2 or on a T2 level, has obviously buttressed both the league and helped populate it. At the same time, I think that the cachet that they believe was going to spiral of teams saying, ooh, we're going to get to play Timbers 2 and we're going to get to play Toronto 2 or Galaxy 2, didn't really come to pass, that there wasn't as much trickle-down cachet of being able to say, ooh, we're going to play Red Bulls 2, that they thought there was going to be. And so from that point of view, from a marketing and a average attendance point of view and facility point of view, which is the big thing, it is turned out to be a little bit of an anchor, particularly as USL tries to get full D2 sanctioning. The vast majority of venues in USL that are under 5,000, which is a boilerplate D2 guideline, are the MLS 2 teams. And that is a sticking point, and that is going to be an issue. And people say, well, you could just transition them to the main stadiums and satisfy it. Well, that's an increased cost for Major League Soccer teams. So there is a to and fro on that level now, where you've got the benefits of your partnership with Major League Soccer, while there is also the cons of the MLS 2 model. That is why we're seeing, and people are acting, you know, some people are acting like this affiliate model, like what Montreal has entered into with Ottawa, is a new form of the partnership. That's actually where the partnership began. The first year was a handful of these affiliates, and it seems like we're gradually seeing signs that USL is retreating back to that because it's more cost efficient. I am still of the belief that we're headed towards this Rio Valley Reno model long term, but I just thought I should point out that when I served up what I thought was an easy play for Jake Edwards on this very topic, that he didn't fully go there, which I found to be interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
and that's the big question mark. Go ahead, Chad.
Everything I was saying before was just with the MLS entrance into USL frame of mind. I didn't mean to imply that independent markets, independent owners in new markets wouldn't still emerge. I just think that from this point forward, when MLS gets involved in having a team, that if they're going to stand up their own team, what they're really going to do is run a farm team the way you described it with a hybrid affiliation. I certainly think that that new ownership groups independent of MLS will be coming into the league for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, I mean, if that's the lead of what could be the future for the lower levels and affiliations of MLS with the hybrid ownership, of course, then I guess Cardick, Reno, and Rio Grande Valley at this particular point in time are not allowed to be in the U.S. Open Cup. So if this is the future, shall we say, Cardick, about lower levels clubs in the NASLs, maybe, you know, we already know about the USL, maybe in the NASL if it does happen, we don't know, we're just speculating, of course. These types of clubs like Rio Grande Valley and Reno are not allowed in the Open Cup, and does that mean U.S. soccer has to make another change to the Open Cup structure?
Yes, potentially. I think that was that decision that was taken before last year's Open Cup began and applies again this season, it appears, could be revisited after next season, especially if we get more of these hybrid-type relationships and less reserve teams, pure reserve teams. Now, I'd spoken to an official at an MLS club over the weekend about their reserve team. That was one of the things that was brought up to me was what Neil mentioned about going from an auxiliary field or a practice facility to opening the main stadium and having to pay for security and all of that sort of thing, that would make what is already cost prohibitive that much worse for them. And I guess I don't have that much sympathy for the MLS teams in the sense that if they want to stock their first teams and be good citizens in player development, as they are trying to be now, and they weren't for the first 10 or 12 or 14 years of Major League Soccer, I think having reserve teams or a elite development squad, something of that nature, is critical for the overall growth of U.S. soccer, however, and the growth of the American player. However, I do understand that this is a business. I think it's good to have reserve teams playing against competitive, professional USL independent teams because that helps raise the level of those youngsters at those MLS reserve teams. But again, that's from a soccer standpoint. I realize everything comes back to profit and loss and business and that kind of trumps soccer considerations. So I don't know. I mean, I think I'd like to see the reserve teams back in the U.S. Open Cup. I know it creates these conflicts with parent clubs potentially down the road in the competition, but it's getting young kids games. And to me, that should have been the overriding consideration in this whole thing and why I thought it was a good thing when MLS opted to not restart its reserve league, but to put reserve teams in USL, because I just think from a soccer player development standpoint, that's important. So personally, I'd like to see the reserve teams back in U.S. Open Cup. I know most people do not agree with me on that. And I hope at least in the case of the Rio Grande Valleys and the Renos and the hybrid teams that they will revisit this decision before next season's Open Cup.
You know, what Chad says is interesting regarding the transition maybe of some of these MLS 2 teams to the hybrid model, as we're calling it, the farm team model, as I call it, because it satisfies two problems. Number one, it gives an independent sense to the teams that USL is looking for and an invested owner who's dedicated to actually marketing a team and putting funding behind that, while at the same time it satisfies Major League Soccer's interest of keeping their mitts on the player development angle, which is something they're utterly reticent to do, which is hand over the training of their players that they loan out or send out on affiliation to coaching staffs and owners funding those coaching staffs that they have no control over. That's a huge issue. The one thing that's still an issue, and it'd be interesting as this evolved, that is still a sticking point with Major League Soccer, is proximity. They want their farm team, again, using a very poor phrase, but it's best to describe it, they want that team relatively close by. I mean, they want it like Philly Union and Bethlehem Steel. They want it where they can shuttle players back and forth for a small amount of money and in a quick fashion, both for rapidity and making quick decisions about who's going to play where this weekend. They don't have to pay a ton of money to fly people all over the country for, and not just expense, but also fatigue. So that's the one issue that has to be worked out, because if you're going to start finding these independent owners that are willing to partner with Major League Soccer teams, which I think you can, you're going to have to find them within a particular radius, I think, because Major League Soccer is not going to have, you know, Portland's not going, you know, Portland and Boise may work out. Portland and San Antonio is not.
Yeah. That's the one thing there that we have to recognize. Now, before, of course, we're going to be finishing up with this discussion soon, I just want to pass this little bit of information. And, of course, Chad, you probably didn't hear this, but Kardik and Neil were on a different podcast at the time. Of course, our colleague, Mr. Simon Evans of Reuters, The Soccer File. Gentlemen, my mother hasn't called this show once. So we're free from that. My mother has not called, so I just want to pass that along. But
yeah,
but
of course, Neil made the great joke about Jonathan Tannenwald getting his having his mother call. Neil, what do you want to go ahead and repeat this? What you said to Simon?
Well, I mean, Jonathan just started a pro-rail conversation, so his mother was calling in, and I said she must not like your position on promotion and relegation. Even she had an opinion about it, I guess. You had to be there.
But I well, let me just say this. My mother, she only knows what happens in the Romanian and the Hungarian leagues. She's not that keen what goes on in MLS these days. So don't worry. She won't call in for that. But anyway, I guess as we get back to the discussion here, with we have a good amount of time remaining here, obviously, before we say goodbye. But, I just have to say that I think we're at a crossroads here. And while everyone who believes that the promotion relegation is the only way to fix this whole situation, which I think with this show we've probably ascertained that's not the only thing that's going to fix the problems, or whether it is through promotion relegation, whether it's sanctioning a league as Division II or Division III, obviously more needs to happen before we even get to that level, if we ever do get to that level. But obviously, we would all agree that at this moment, it's the money aspects about the lower levels, and at the same time, it's MLS running some form of reserve league, which they don't want to do. They would rather let USL run, or if USL or NASL wants to run a reserve league by themselves with their MLS teams. I think that's probably the only way that's going to happen. But once again, where does the money come in to play? And I think that's the number one issue here we have, gentlemen. First with Neil, then with Chad, and then Kardec. Money will always trump everything that is not going to be sustainable unless you are financially sound. And I think I have been the only one that has been stressing this for such a long period of time here. I think at the end of the day, gentlemen, and once again, we'll go with Neil, Chad, and then Kardec, money does make the world go round. Neil first.
Well, you haven't exactly broken news there, Daniel. yes, money is where it all ultimately ends up. Look, I've already spoken about the whole reason that we had this whole D2 sanctioning drama over the last several months. Comes down to money. It comes down to retaining owners and attracting investors. It may seem silly, but you know, when you have people who are worth $20 million or more who are willing to go into a losing business of lower division soccer, there's a suspension of disbelief and a level of insanity there. And they have to be willing to lose a bunch of money or think that they're going to end up in Major League Soccer one day. And they have to be willing to part with money. And that's ultimately what it's all about. But at the same time, I think, you know, and I've made this point on a couple of other podcasts, NASL has talked about trying to institute, maybe on an informal basis, some financial constraints and cost controls. And we'll see. We'll see where the rubber hits the road. And I certainly hope that that's true. But what I do know is true is that there's a couple of owners in that league that probably aren't going to really buy into that. But there is a confederation of owners in that league that I am positive have now seen the example of the New York Cosmos, let's call it 2.0. They have seen a team come in, spend tens of millions of dollars, lost tens of millions of dollars, won three or four championships, advance a little ways in the U.S. Open Cup, get as much or more attention than any other lower division team in the United States, and all that got them for their trouble was being on the cusp of imploding overnight. They finally saw that the Cosmos model does not spin gold. And I've made this point to a number of people, including Cardiff, when we start talking about the new NESL. You know, of the existing six owners in the league, I'm sorry, seven owners, five of them have been involved for less than 2 years. So we can talk about a carryover in attitude or a change in attitude, but it is a new group of people in that league. This is not the old TOA or even the vestiges of it, other than Tom Pfaff, I suppose. It's a new league, but they've also seen that pouring a bunch of money and winning championships doesn't mean that there's going to be a happy tomorrow. And I would hope that there are a number of, or that the majority of that league, you know, if Ricardo Silva wants to keep up buying every midfielder in the NASL, like Dylan Mahrez or whomever, well, heck, let him do it. If he wants to gobble up a trophy of an 18 league, well, let him do it. But at the end of the day, you've got to look at your bottom line, and you've got to protect your club. And while that seems to be self-explanatory, it has not always been the preoccupation of the owners in the NESL, going back to the original breakaways. Now, it was always a preoccupation of Traffic Sports, interestingly enough, but it was not a preoccupation of the Cosmos or the Wellmans or whomever. I hope it's going to be the focus of the owners of that league going forward, because if they can get their house in order, if they can exercise the fortitude necessary to institute cost controls in a truly independent club model, they can have a future. But that's where the money part of this comes in. Yes, the big money always talks, but big money can also land you in a tar pit.
Chad?
Yeah, I mean, what's the old saying? If you want to make $1 billion, you know, become a whale tycoon. And if you want to lose it, buy a soccer team. It's not easy to make money in the world of soccer as an owner. It's especially not easy to make money in the world of lower division American soccer. So it becomes a question of why the owners get involved. And if they're not getting involved to make money, presumably there's some amount of pride in owning a club whose success is defined by its success on the pitch. So you got to find a way to minimize your losses at the same time investing enough into your club to bring home some silverware. And that's what it, if you're not going to make money, that's what it comes down to. It's personal pride for the owners. So you've got to manage your business, in this case your business being a lower division American soccer club, in a responsible enough way that your losses are worth what it costs to bring home the silverware.
And Kardik, I think, saving you for last, I think you're the biggest example of everybody here, obviously. I mean, you know, you write for World Soccer Talk. You've handled EPL talk, MLS talk, of course, with Harris. You're behind the scenes with the NESL when it first got started as your first ever communications manager. Of course, working with the Fort Lauderdale Strikers in their department, now with Boca Raton FC. I think you're the best one, because I saved you for last for a reason, to answer this question, because you've been through everything.
Oh, thank you for that, Daniel. Yeah, I think that it's very, very difficult, and I completely agree with what Chad said, very difficult to break even at this level, and you have to have some degree of realistic expectations, and perhaps winning on the pitch is important and it's a vanity play for some owners, or perhaps creating an in-game experience that's really memorable and neat and keeps bringing people back to the stadium like they have done in Charleston for years is what lower division soccer should be about. And I think that's why the Charleston Battery, in spite of the limitations of that market, have been a successful team for 20 years, for two decades, when we see teams come and go. I just want to address, I wish it had come up sooner, and I thank Neil for bringing it up. There's a lot of rhetoric coming out of the NASL these days about being more humble, being more realistic, cost control measures, which I think sounded very good. I was sitting at the Boca Raton FC office today with a couple of other knowledgeable soccer people, Pedro Heiser, who of course writes about this also and is also working for the club, when the Dylan Mayer's news came out, and we said, uh-oh, here we go again with Miami FC, and here we go again with NASL. Clearly, they haven't learned anything. Now, I should say, though, that if one team wants to spend a lot of money and nobody else tries to match them, and as Neil says, great, they run the table in an 18 league and they get whatever trophy comes out of it, then it's okay. The danger is if now, having seen Miami go and poach one of the best young players, USL has a far greater arsenal of really good young players than NASL does. Dylan Mayer's is in the top three in my list of good young NASL players, and he's just been poached. If that starts again and another team decides they want to compete with Miami, then you might have an implosion. And that's where this money factor comes in again, where you have to be realistic about your expectations. You have to understand financially what you're getting into. And I think Neil was right. A number of NASL owners saw what happened with the New York Cosmos, and to a lesser extent with Fort Lauderdale, who spent an awful lot of money, more money than people realize. And I can attest to that on players. And Jacksonville, who spent an awful lot of money on things that they didn't need to spend money on at the Division II level, and have now opted to pull back and be more disciplined in how they spend on players and technical staff and on that side of the sporting side, and maybe invest some of those savings into marketing and building long-term local infrastructure that sustains clubs. So I think that's what has to be done. There are several examples throughout U.S. soccer of really good clubs that have made a go of it at this level. Charleston, I mentioned, is a great example. There are more recent examples than that, but that would be, for me, the standout one. And let's hope that there's more Charlestons and less New York Cosmos or Miami FCs going forward.
So as we get set to put the kibosh on this discussion, final questions for one for Neil, one for Chad here before I finish up with Kardik. So, Neil, the NASLs, we've already said, eight teams, and they are, of course, Indy 11. Jacksonville still remains, Miami FC, New York Cosmos, FC Edmonton, of course, the renamed now North Carolina FC, Puerto Rico FC, and the West Coast team in San Francisco Deltas. Are we going to see these proposed NASL clubs coming out of San Diego, Orange County, California, Detroit City FC? Are we even going to see, do they even dare bring back an Atlanta club that will be in the NASL in the years to come if they are going to survive this this provisional second division sanctioning into 2018?
Well, I think each of these are a case-by-case basis, and the sands change on a daily basis for some of these. I, as far as what I've heard, I think Orange County is on its final stages. Now, I hesitate to say it's going to happen. I reported 2 or 3 years ago that the NESL was days away from announcing a LA team that never came to fruition because the bottom fell out. So things can change. I think the Orange County effort is real, and although I don't have particulars about it, I think that's probably going to be one of the ones that's announced for 2018 if I had to handicap it. The San Diego effort is going to be fascinating because it sounds like USL is priming their own announcement in March. And then you had, of all people, Demba Ba going on the radio and saying that him and Eden Hazard and some other players were part of the investment side of an NESL team that's negotiating with to be in San Diego, NESL team in San Diego, which I think that there's Midfield Press has more information on this that they're not at liberty to disclose. I think there's going to be a local ownership side to this. So those two, I would say, are in the short run. The Chicago effort, which everyone assumed is going to launch in 2018, that Peter Wilt's involved with. I heard an interview with Peter last Friday where he said that he hopes that the team will launch in 2018 or perhaps 2019. It's the first time I've ever heard him hedge on that and push it to a possible 2019. So I wonder what the status of that is. Atlanta, oh my goodness. That's another one that Kartik and I have had many conversations about, and my opinion is this. Don't go there. Do not go back into that boondoggle. It was a boondoggle before Atlanta United was there. There are people who believe that this whole effort out in the suburbs is going to be real, and I frankly don't even want to hear about it unless and until this major soccer complex with all these businesses that are around it that sounds all Virginia Cavalier-y. If that comes to fruition, and if it happens, and if they have an actual complex and an actual owner that is of net worth who wants an NASL team, then I will start listening. Other than that, they need to stay away, danger Will Robinson, and let that be that.
Or is the new version is called Stranger Danger? Stranger Danger? No. all right, Chad. Next for you, of course, the way the USL is going so far, and of course there are rumors of them adding on other teams. Of course, we all know Wilmington Hammerhead sadly no longer in the USL League. They are relegated themselves to the PDL, which if they feel it's better suited for them, so be it. But I feel bad that they're no longer in the top level of USL playing soccer days and stuff like that. But the way that Jake Edwards has run this league, what future is in store for them in years to come?
That's a great question. We talked the last time we were all together about USL Productions and what a positive thing that might be for the league in terms of how it gets the games out on a digital platform and the deal with ESPN in terms of producing games. I'd like to see where this goes and what kind of media relationships develop out of USL Productions. If we can get a reasonable television deal that exposes the league to a larger segment of the population, but one that is financially feasible for the league. Of course, expansion is always big news, and looks like we could be having a team out in San Diego. I know there are ownership groups in Baltimore who are interested. I've also heard rumors about an ownership group in Cleveland who's interested. I think one thing USL is looking to do is to even regionalize its schedule more than it has already and move to, instead of an Eastern and Western conference, but to also add a Central conference. So there's probably some teams in the middle of America that need to be added before that can be done in a responsible fashion in terms of getting balanced conferences and a balanced schedule for each conference. So those are the kinds of things that I'm looking for out of USL in the future.
And Kartik, I guess my last question towards you on this subject is this. Let's just say for the heck of it that U.S. Soccer might broach both commissioners or whoever's going to be the commissioner of the NASL. I know there's no one at the moment, but let's just say there is. They'll broach both commissioners to say, let's come together and let's just have one full second division league. No NASL, no USL. You can call it whatever you want. You can call it U.S. Soccer D2 again if you'd like. But once again, what would happen if Sunil Gulati broached both leagues and said, let's merge into one and not worry about who's right and who's wrong in this situation? Do you think that would be a lot better? And then maybe talk to NPSL or PDL to be giving them Division III status if that is still viable.
Well, Division III let me start with that first. That's an easier answer. I don't think either league is ready for Division III. There are a handful of NPSL teams that are ready for Division III, and there are a handful of PDL teams. You probably would have to start a hybrid league at the Division III level with five NPSL teams and five PDL teams, and then you lose your regionalization, you lose your cost model, your cost control model. So I think you wait on D3. I think maybe we go several years without a Division III league, or maybe a new league forms that's regional, and it's a Division III league. It's a Pacific Coast league that's a Division III league and only plays in California, Oregon, and Washington, something like that. Or a Mid-Atlantic league that plays from Neil's area
up towards Massachusetts, and you can control costs that way. But I don't think you're going to have a national D3 for a while. So that's the first part. To the potential merger between USL and NASL, I think that that's a logical thing. I do think you would have to work out some of the business nuances of things. I have to say, there's been a lot of misinterpretation of events. USL did not want to accept a lot of these NASL teams. That much I can say is true. Now, it's not totally ego-driven. One of the things that has to be stated that I've heard from multiple people on the USL side, at USL clubs, is that there was a concern about the discipline or lack of discipline among NASL clubs when it comes to spending on players and spending on coaches and doing that sort of thing, that if you let Miami FC into USL and you let Indy 11 into USL and you let the New York Cosmos into USL, you're going to raise the cost for every other USL club because they're going to have to spend X amount more money on players and they're going to have to do that much more to compete on the field when they're having enough of a hard time making ends meet with all the costs they have to incur already at the USL level. So if NASL's clubs are really entering a new era where they are going to have cost control, they're going to be more disciplined, and as Neil says, they saw what happened with the New York Cosmos and to a lesser extent with Jacksonville and Fort Lauderdale, and they're ready to tighten their belts, I think there can be an arrangement after this season. Now, if Miami FC continues to spend money, as we saw today, indicated by a signing that was announced today, the way they had last season, I think that we may not get to that, and we might be going through this whole saga again a year from now. I really think it boils down to that from talking to people, that if NASL's clubs are willing to reduce their costs on players, not on marketing, not on any of the other things around their teams, but on players and technical staff. That's another thing, overpaying for coaches, overpaying for general managers, and buy into the kind of the infrastructure USL has, which includes combines, which includes partnerships, which allow scouting, you know, easier scouting than you have at the NASL level. Club services, and obviously Chad mentions USL Productions, which I think personally is going to be one of the great game changers at the lower division level in American soccer, and I'm very, very excited about it. But that's for another show. If you have NASL teams willing to buy into that stuff and buy into the premise of that stuff, the individual clubs, I think we get a merger a year from now. But it's going to take a cultural change among some of the NASL owners. But based on what Neil's saying, and I know he's spoken to a few owners and to a few people that are high-ranking officials within NASL, maybe that cultural change is happening, and we'll get what we need to move the sport forward a year from now.
Well, at least they're not going to have a club called the Down Eastwood Ducks, right, Neil?
Yeah, very much so. Besmirching the vestiges of my minor league baseball childhood, yes.
That's right. They're brand new this year. But anyway, gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. I always appreciate it. With everything that you do in lower division soccer as well as American soccer as a whole. Once again, Carter Krishnayer, Neil Morris, Chad Hollingsworth, thank you very much for the time. I appreciate it. And I'll talk to you during the season as well as there's going to be two friendlies with the U.S. national team under Bruce Arena once again. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Have a good night and talk to you next time.
Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
And once again, ladies and gentlemen, this has been Four Scenes Fire American Soccer Show, number 311, the lower level sanctioning review show. I want to thank my guests once again, Neil Morris, Chad Hollingsworth, and Carter Krishnayer. My name's Daniel Feuerstein. Thank you very much for listening tonight. As always, please enjoy your football. Take care and talk to you next week. Bye-bye for now.